is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Wednesday, December 4th. The House Judiciary Committee, which would write actual articles of impeachment, has begun its series of impeachment hearings with a panel today of four academics who are anything but academic. In fact, we'll begin with one early statement from Stanford Law Professor Pamela Carlin. The ranking Republican on the committee, Doug Collins of Georgia, has suggested that as academics, the witnesses were concerned with abstract things, not the facts of this case. Professor Carlin included a response to that in her opening statement.
I read transcripts of every one of the witnesses who appeared in the live hearing because I would not speak about these things without reviewing the facts. So I'm insulted by the suggestion that as a law professor, I don't care about those facts. But everything I read on those occasions tells me that when President Trump invited, indeed demanded foreign involvement in our upcoming election, he struck at the very heart of what makes this a republic to which we pledge allegiance. That demand, as Professor Feldman just explained, constituted an abuse of power. Indeed, as I want to explain in my testimony, drawing a foreign government into our elections is an especially serious abuse of power because it undermines democracy itself.
Undermines democracy itself. Stanford Law Professor Pamela Carlin, who is one of the four law professors on today's panel. Under the usual House hearing rules, the majority party gets to call three witnesses, the minority party gets to call one, and that's what happened here. Three law professors called by the Democrats, she was one of them, one called by Republicans. Harvard Law Professor Noah Feldman was another called by the Democrats. Again, this is not just academic. Feldman argued that the president appears guilty of an impeachable act of abuse of power.
The abuse of office occurs when the president uses a feature of his power, the awesome power of his office, not to serve the interests of the American public, but to serve his personal, individual, partisan, electoral interests. That is what the evidence before the House indicates.
Harvard Law Professor Noah Feldman. We'll hear from Feldman and Professor Carlin as we go. The law professor the Republicans called is Jonathan Turley from George Washington University. He established himself as no fan of President Trump, did not vote for him, voted for Presidents Obama and Clinton in the past. But still, he said this impeachment is wrong.
It's not wrong because President Trump is right. His call was anything but perfect. It's not wrong because the House has no legitimate reason to investigate the Ukrainian controversy. It's not wrong because we're in an election year. There is no good time for an impeachment. No, it's wrong because this is not how you impeach an American president. This case is not a case of the unknowable. It's a case of the peripheral. We have a record of conflicts, defenses that have not been fully considered, unsubpoenaed witness with material evidence. To impeach a president on this record would expose every future president to the same type of inchoate impeachment. Principle often takes us to a place we would prefer not to be.
That was George Washington University Professor Jonathan Turley. We'll hear more from him, too. Before we bring in our guest, an impeachment law professor himself, here's just a very brief taste of the different paths the Democratic and Republican committee members are on. The very first sentence spoken this morning by Chairman Gerald Nadler, Democrat from New York, was just these six words.
The facts before us are undisputed.
The facts before us are undisputed. But the Republicans are disputing the facts, and they're also saying this.
This impeachment is not really about facts.
Ranking Republican Doug Collins of Georgia.
You just don't like the guy. You haven't liked him since November of 2016. The chairman has talked about impeachment since last year when he was elected chairman, 2 years ago, November 6th, 17th, before he's even sworn in as chairman. So don't tell me this is about new evidence and new things and new stuff. We may have a new hearing room, we may have new mics, and we may have chairs that aren't comfortable, but this is nothing new, folks. This is sad.
With me now, Philip Bobbitt, director of the Center for National Security at Columbia University. He has served in all three branches of the federal government, was legal counsel to the Senate Iran-Contra Committee, which investigated that scandal that for a time had people talking about a possible impeachment of President Ronald Reagan. He is the author of 10 books and a new preface to the classic 1970s book, Impeachment, A Handbook, by Charles Black. Professor Bobbitt, we're grateful for your time. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Did you enjoy seeing law professors in the spotlight for once rather than politicians?
Well, I thought the law professors acquitted our profession very well. They were well-prepared. They were powerful. They were articulate. So I suppose I did enjoy that.
Let's talk about some of the clips that we just heard. First, I think if I had to state what I think is a lead angle today, it's not necessarily the law and the standards for impeachment under the Constitution, not yet anyway. It's that the Republicans are not conceding what the Democrats call the facts. And we heard that, for example, in the answer there by Professor Turley. He called the Democrats' case for impeachment inchoate. Good vocabulary word for people, it means not fully formed. So, for example, he argued elsewhere that if they keep investigating, maybe they can close the loop on questions like if the president actually directed a demand for investigations in exchange for military aid, because the fact is not established. How much do you think that's where they are right now in terms of the two sides arguing their cases?
I wouldn't have put it quite like that. I'd say what you say is only partly right. Turley tried to redefine the meaning of an impeachable offense to be the same as that for statutory or common crimes. So a high crime, in his view, is to be construed the way we construe statutory crimes.
Meaning beyond a reasonable doubt?
Well, not so much the standard of proof as the elements of a crime. And only having established that sort of theoretical floor does he then go on and say, and we don't have the facts for that. So the theory is really quite crucial here. If you differed on what constituted a high crime and misdemeanor or bribery, then you wouldn't have a lack of the elements that Turley pointed to.
So what did he argue was the difference between that and an ordinary criminal case?
In the McDonald case, a recent Supreme Court case.
About bribery.
A recent Supreme Court case about the bribery alleged to a former governor. The court gave a very narrow definition of bribery. That's not unreasonable. Bribery is quite difficult to prove because we all have mixed motives. And the court was willing to give the politicians some space, for example, helping constituents, calling meetings, the sort of pay-for-play phenomenon, because you couldn't isolate the corrupt motive from the ordinary processes of politics. That's not what the framers were really concerned about when they talked about bribery. But you do still have some of the same problems. But the elements are different. Because Turley subtly moved the elements to those of a common crime, he had a much stricter, much tighter, and much more formulaic role for proof.
Why would it be broader for a presidential impeachment? It's such a consequential thing. Why should the standard of proof be lower if that's the right way to characterize it?
Maybe broader is not the right way to put it. What I have in mind is this. The crimes that serve as the basis for an impeachment may be crimes of a statutory nature, but that's rather rare. Crimes such as cheating on your income tax or using narcotics or something of that kind probably wouldn't be the basis for an impeachment. On the other hand, a famous example given by Charles Black of a president who moves to Saudi Arabia so he can have four wives and conducts his office from there, has not committed a crime, but he's clearly doing something impeachable. The crimes that are contemplated by the Constitution as a basis for impeachment are crimes against the integrity and the legitimacy of the state itself. So maybe broader isn't the right word, but they are quite different.
They're particular in that way. So to Turley's argument about needing more proof, some things that are established, Trump's ambassador, Gordon Sondland, told President Zelensky's aide, Andrei Yermak, on September 1st that he, Sondland, presumed the aide would not be released until Ukraine issued the public corruption statement that they had been discussing for many weeks. On August 11th, Yermak sent Trump aide Kurt Volker a draft of a statement promising to fight corruption, but in general terms. And Volker asked Yermak in a text message, so there's documentary evidence, to add, quote, the two key items. And guess what? Yermak's next draft included Burisma and the 2016 election. So as a lawyer, could you establish that a shakedown of Ukraine had happened even in conventional criminal terms, and could you tie the president closely enough to it?
It would be a hard sell. You could certainly get a grand jury. You could probably say there's a probable cause that a crime has been committed, but you'd have to show to a jury satisfaction that there was no other reasonable explanation. And the president himself has contradicted Sondland's testimony and said that that's not at all what he had in mind. And the Republicans on the committee have repeatedly said that the use of the word, I presume this, I concluded this, show that Sondland didn't have the sort of hard evidence that you'd have in a criminal trial. But again, that's a slightly different standard.
Though, wouldn't the Republicans have to offer some kind of alternative theory of why Trump's appointees were only demanding those specific statements from Ukraine at all? They only argue so far, the Republicans, that any example of potential corruption or election interference is fair game to demand an investigation of, but the record indicates they only cared about those two that were specifically relevant to getting Trump reelected. Or am I missing something?
I think you're missing the Republicans' point that you could have both a fixation on reelection and animus towards your opponent and still be concerned about corruption, and that Biden's son, the role of the vice president in anti-corruption efforts that seem to have had, if only inadvertently, the effect of protecting his son's company, that these things were mixed in their motives in the president's
eyes.
Even
if those are the only two things they ever bring up.
Even if those are the only two things that had resonance with the president's representatives, because the president is saying that that's not at all what he had in mind.
Let's listen to some more clips. Here's Stanford Law Professor Pamela Carlin again, citing President Ronald Reagan on why she thinks it's vital to our democracy and to global democracy that the standard of not using personal gain as a factor in foreign policy be upheld.
We have become what John Winthrop said in his sermon in 1640 and what Ronald Reagan said in his final address to the country as he left office. We have become the shining city on a hill. We have become the nation that leads the world in understanding what democracy is. And one of the things we understand most profoundly is it's not a real democracy. It's not a mature democracy if the party in power uses the criminal process to go after its enemies. And I think you heard testimony, the Intelligence Committee heard testimony about how it isn't just our national interest in protecting our own elections. It's not just our national interest in making sure that the Ukraine remains strong and on the front line so they fight the Russians there and we don't have to fight them here. But it's also our national interest in promoting democracy worldwide. And if we look hypocritical about this, if we look like we're asking other countries to interfere in our election, if we look like we're asking other countries to engage in criminal investigations of our president's political opponents, then we're not doing our job of promoting our national interest in being that shining city on a hill.
Professor Carlin, called by the Democrats. Professor Bobbitt, what were you thinking during that?
Well, it was a very stirring moment, and I thought a very forceful point. It could have even been made more forceful if she had relied more on Winthrop and less on Reagan. We often hear this phrase about a city on the hill, but when John Winthrop said it, he did not say it because we would be a shining example to the world. Quite the contrary. He said that the world was going to look on us with great skepticism and great suspicion to see if we were hypocrites, professing religious fidelity that we didn't really practice. It's a much more cautionary a sermon that Winthrop gives. And I think an even more powerful point now, because so many places around the world, particularly in Russia, say that the Americans really are a bunch of hypocrites and that the democratic values they assert are just a sham.
So do you think the difference between your interpretation and her interpretation of what matters there is relevant to the question of impeaching Donald Trump?
Probably not. Whether it's a matter of hypocrisy or whether it's a matter of democracy promotion, in either case, it doesn't strengthen our national security
to do this kind of thing. And again now, Professor Turley called by the Republicans, this time arguing that the evidence has not established obstruction of justice simply because Trump is withholding so many witnesses and documents, like in the Nixon articles of impeachment.
I've been a critic of the third article of the Nixon impeachment my whole life. My hair catches on fire every time someone mentions the third article. Why? Because you would be replicating one of the worst articles written on impeachment. Here's the reason why. Peter Rodino's position as chairman of judiciary was that Congress alone decides what information may be given to it. Alone. His position was that the courts have no role in this. And so, by that theory, any refusal by a president based on executive privilege or immunities would be the basis of impeachment. That is essentially the theory that's being replicated today. President Trump has gone to Congress, to the courts. He's allowed to do that. We have three branches, not two.
Professor Bobbitt, would you like to reflect on what Professor Turley said in that clip?
Well, I'm quite sympathetic to the general point that the president has a grounds for executive privilege, that he has to keep his deliberations a secret. And I would be very alarmed if what Professor Turley referred to as the Rodino position were to become our law of impeachment. But it's not the case to say that because Congress alone determines the standards for its subpoenas, that Congress is determining them lawlessly. Congress can determine many things, as indeed a president can with respect to pardons and appointments, in which Congress is the sole actor. But there are rules and there are laws. And it isn't beyond the capability of Congress to negotiate executive privilege. I've done this myself on behalf of the White House.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when you have this complete stonewall that Congress, I think, can say, we don't have to take this to courts and wait 6 to 9 months to know that we can't do our job. We can't find out the facts in the face of such obstruction.
And that's what's happening here. So there's an interesting line that I guess depends on your point of view as to whether they're on the right side of the line, meaning they should argue each one of those refusals to provide a witness or a document in court, and that's normal, or if it's abnormal and therefore obstruction because there's such a blanket withholding.
Yes.
You were counsel to the Senate Iran-Contra Committee, I see. That scandal had some similarities to this one. I think it's fair to say Congress had passed a law blocking aid to the Contra rebels in Nicaragua, but Reagan ignored that law and sent them aid anyway. It's kind of the opposite of this, in which Congress mandated aid to Ukraine and Trump or his minions withheld it. How would you compare Iran-Contra to Trump-Ukraine?
Actually, I think it may be quite similar because in both cases, the crucial nexus between congressional authorizations and appropriations and the president's authority to act was smudged or even obliterated.
Would it be fair, in your opinion, to say that this is similar to Iran-Contra in that way that you described of the executive ignoring appropriations or blocking appropriations that Congress had voted on? Worse, however, because in Reagan's case, the motivation was to do what he genuinely thought was in the U.S. national interest. And in Trump's case, it appears that he was just acting in his private interest.
Well, I have no doubt that President Trump thinks that's also in the national interest.
Really?
Yes, I'm sure he thinks that his reelection is in the national interest.
His reelection.
Yes, that wouldn't be
as opposed to withholding his aid from Ukraine.
That wouldn't be unknown. But he's withholding aid, it is alleged, to secure his election. This is really sort of Act Two. If Act One was what about the emails, lock her up, then Act Two is the vice president's corrupt, lock him up, and I think it's all linked, if these charges are proven true, to that maneuver. I'm very pleased, though, that you do see this connection. There's even another connection between the two phenomena, the two affairs, and that is that in the Iran-Contra affair, I think the investigators were led astray by trying to find that the president had committed a common crime. And so we chased this diversion argument that the president had taken money that should have been in the Treasury and instead spent it on supporting the Contras and other activities. Here, too, the debate is moving towards trying to establish a common crime, which is not, I repeat, it is not the constitutional standard for impeachment.
There was talk of impeaching Ronald Reagan over that kind of privatization of foreign policy. Why didn't it get very far?
Well, I think it was very unlikely that the president really was paying that much attention to an accounting method of whether the money went here or there and to what accounts.
It was happening under his radar.
I think so. And the much more substantial question, the constitutional question you drew attention to, setting up a private covert action agency and using the facilities and the power of the government to do so, that issue really kind of never had any traction.
And that's the same issue that Jonathan Turley, law professor called by the Republicans, was arguing today that hasn't been established here. They didn't establish, in his opinion, that Trump directed it. They never did establish that Reagan directed it in Iran-Contra. The last clip I want to play is actually from Chairman Gerald Nadler, but from back in 1998 during the Clinton impeachment when the Republicans were driving toward impeachment. Mm-hmm.
There must never be a narrowly voted impeachment or an impeachment substantially supported by one of our major political parties and largely opposed by the other. Such an impeachment would lack legitimacy, would produce divisiveness and bitterness in our politics for years to come, and will call into question the very legitimacy of our political institution.
Jerry Nadler in 1998. Professor, do the founders, as you understand them, have anything to say about one-party impeachments, even if that party has an elected majority?
They don't say anything I'm aware of on that particular issue, but they do repeatedly emphasize that the Senate is supposed to act as a jury, that it is to try the case, to take a special oath. The proceedings are administered by the Chief Justice, and then he presides over the trial. They repeatedly say that the senators have to put aside their partisanship and their attachment to parties. I wonder how realistic that is today.
Well, to that point, and finally, Professor, in your portion of Impeachment, a Handbook, the version published last year, you wrote that perhaps the most important development since Nixon has been the transfer of influence from the organs of government decision-making to the public. You wrote, "We no longer have the confidence in the leadership of Congress that we had in the Nixon era. One reason we have lost that confidence is the fiasco of the Clinton impeachment by the House." So do you think it's bad that public opinion matters so much to the fate of an impeachment process?
Probably, but there's not a thing I can do about it. Because it's the same sort of phenomenon as you'd have in a jury in other circumstances. You would like a dispassionate trial of law and facts. You'd like to be instructed on the law, and then you'd like to apply the facts fairly, whether the president is your party or not. Popular opinion is a very...
passionate?
A very changeable thing. And if you sacrifice the rule of law in favor of chasing the polls, I think you will actually end up undermining democracy.
Professor Bobbitt, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Some of you know that we've been inviting listeners to Impeachment, a daily podcast, to write and record one article of impeachment of your own. What language would you use to charge Trump under the Constitution? And this is last call. We'll close this out on Thursday and turn the page and invite Trump defenders to call in our next round and say why not to impeach. But here is an article of impeachment from one of you.
The president violated his duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed in violation of Article 2, Section 3, Clause 5 of the United States Constitution by taking too many vacation days, spending too much time on Twitter and watching TV instead of doing his job, by lying voluminously, and by causing substantial harm to the international reputation of the United States.
Thank you for taking the time to write and record that. And now, as the Judiciary Committee moves toward their articles of impeachment, this is last call for yours. They can be about Ukraine or not. And next week, we'll invite Trump supporters to write for the defense. Our article of impeachment voicemail is 844-745-TALK, 844-745-8255, 844-745-TALK. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. See you tomorrow.